You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. And this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
Automated decision-making. We've visited the subject in the numerous episodes covering developments in artificial intelligence. But here we turn our attention to a specific aspect of ADM, which is the duty under data protection law of any information processor to make that decision-making transparent to the data subject. Technology, as we know, is rapidly changing how government makes decisions and the avenues by which people can challenge those decisions. Anything to do with algorithmic decision-making is complex. In fact, when I clicked on the government's link to its so-called Algorithmic Transparency Standard website, I got a page of gibberish, which kind of tells its own story. Happily, I have with me two members of the Public Law Project to clarify the issue. Ariane Adam is the legal director of PLP, and Tatiana Kazim is research fellow in public law and technology there. Tatiana and Ariane, welcome to LawPod UK.
Thank you so much for having us, Rosalind. It's a pleasure.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
The House of Lords Justice and Home Affairs Committee has just brought out its report on the advent of new technologies in the justice system. They talk about a new Wild West in which new technologies are developing so fast that government can't keep up. Automated decision-making is, of course, at the heart of their concerns. What are your worries, Tatiana, at the PLP?
We have a number of worries, really, but I think the starting point is really about the opacity around government's use of automated decision-making tools. People don't always realise this, but as you said in the introduction, automated decision-making in government is really common now and increasingly so. And it's seeping into many aspects of people's daily lives. You might quite reasonably assume that a human being is making decisions about, say, your visa application or your benefits application or whether you should be subject to a police investigation. But that isn't always true. Nowadays, it's often an algorithm that either makes this decision entirely or at least supports the human to make a decision. And when this is happening in so many contexts, you might well ask, why don't people know more about it? And the answer is really quite simple and somewhat worrying. It's that governments are deliberately keeping us in the dark. And our concern really is that if these technologies are being deployed without kind of being in the public eye, then there's no opportunity for kind of debate and consensus building about when use of new technologies is appropriate. And it makes it really difficult for affected individuals to hold government to account when things go wrong, when these automated systems have flaws or are unfair or are discriminatory.
I seem to remember you say in your Prospect article that ADM systems should not be in a black box. In other words, should not be impenetrable, invisible. We need to know, you say, what is going on inside. But how do you propose this happens?
So we think that the Algorithmic Transparency Standard is a really good first step. This is a pilot project being run by the Cabinet Office, which basically asks government departments to provide information about the ADM systems that they're using. But it really is only a first step, and we think the second iteration has to go a lot further. There's three kind of main things that we would really like to see in terms of allowing us to see inside those black boxes and allowing us to see what's going on. The first is that provision of information to the ATS must be mandatory. At the moment, government departments don't have to provide information to the ATS. They can if they want to. And, you know, in our experience, when we do FOI requests or try to investigate ADM systems, government departments are often unwilling to share information. So that leads us to believe that perhaps they'll be unwilling to share information to the ATS as well. And that's why it really needs to be a mandatory system. The second thing we'd like to see is a lot more detail about the ADM systems that are being used. At the moment, we worry that their ATS would include high-level information, but not enough of the nuts and bolts about how the system really works. And without those nuts and bolts, people are going to be unable to challenge an unfair adverse decision that's made about them. And then finally, I think it's really important that the ATS is held by an independent body who's able to check that government departments are actually providing meaningful information about all the systems that they're using and who are able to enforce provision of information.
Could either of you or both of you give me examples of errors in public life where automated decision making is routinely used and affects individuals?
So one of the systems that we are really worried about is what we're calling the sham marriages algorithm. So that's an ADM system used by the Home Office to decide whether to investigate a couple who's given notice to be married on suspicion of their being in a sham relationship. So not a genuine relationship, but one to circumvent immigration rules. And we have a number of concerns about this system. First of all, it goes back to this issue of transparency. There are some references to the sham marriages algorithm in publicly available documents, but most of what we've been able to find out has been via FOI requests. And even then, there's still a lot that we don't know. So, for example, we're told that the system uses 8 risk factors to decide whether a couple passes or fails the triage process. If they pass the triage process, they won't be investigated. If they fail the triage process, then that flags them for investigation. The 8 risk factors that are used, only 3 of them are in the public eye. They are shared travel events, observations of the registrar as to how the couple are interacting in the registrar's office, and age difference. But there are 5 factors that are totally unknown at present. One related concern we have is that some couples with certain ethnic backgrounds and nationalities seem to be flagged for investigation at a much higher rate than others. So those are Albanian, Bulgarian, Romanian, and Greek people. They're flagged at a higher rate. And we worry that potentially those 5 unknown risk factors are in some way related to nationality or proxies for nationality.
To add to Tatiana's explanation of this algorithm, it's important to highlight that the only reason we know that level of information is because we have made freedom of information requests when we first suspected that an algorithm is being used for this decision-making process. So even the criteria that has been disclosed has only been disclosed in response to such requests. Now, making such requests is not simple. One needs to have a certain level of experience of using the Freedom of Information Act to make them. It's also not quick. Government departments often delay disclosure beyond the statutory time limit. And so it can sometimes take months to receive this basic level of information. And it's concerning that this is the approach to introducing these systems in decision making. We suspect that algorithms are being used, for example, increasingly by the Department for Work and Pensions in order to assess people's entitlements to benefits or in order to investigate fraudulent claims in relation to benefits. But again, we don't have sufficient information as to what algorithms are being used, how, why they're being used, and the extent to which they're influencing decision making. A related concern with this is, what is the faith in these systems, and are they being introduced without sufficiently testing them? Technology in and of itself can be a good or a bad thing. It's a tool, and whether it's good or bad depends on how you use it, and it depends on how much you test it before you use it. You can have a really simple system. Take, for example, a really current topic in the news, which is the post office scandal. The post office used an accountancy tool, a simple machine when you compare it to complex artificial intelligence systems. It used an accountancy tool from 1999 until I think about 2014 that was deployed across different branches of the post office. Now, that accountancy software, which was called Horizon, made it look like money was missing from sites when it wasn't. And that led to convictions of more than 700 branch managers. It has taken a long time to discover that these were in fact mistakes made by a machine rather than actual fraud being committed by post office managers. In the meantime, you have had such detrimental effect on people's lives, people that had convictions for these issues. It has also led to a very hefty bill because now damages need to be paid. And I understand they exceed 58 million together with costs. And so that shouldn't be the way we do things. We shouldn't just adopt a system, not really tell people that we are adopting it, not really tell people how we are making decisions about them, and then not having systems of evaluation once we do adopt it to make sure that it actually works and it's actually doing what it's meant to be doing and it's not making mistakes which in the context of immigration or benefits or policing or prison categorization, they can have really harmful impacts on people's lives. And so we really welcome the Justice and Home Affairs Committee's recommendation and comment that evaluation is central, but evaluation depends on transparency, because without transparency of information, you can't really assess how it's working in practice.
One of the difficulties that the House of Lords report points up is that technology itself is provided by technology producers who don't want to disclose details inside the technology for commercial confidentiality purposes. Now, how are we going to get around that?
Well, there is already precedent on how we go around that, and there is precedent within our public law. There is a case that we like to refer to at the Public Law Project when talking about this issue of ASI, a National Institute for Health and Criminal Excellence. It's a case back from 2008 before the Court of Appeal. Now, the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence is responsible for appraising clinical benefits and cost effectiveness of drugs. And it was using a model in order to assess the cost benefits and the cost efficiencies of ASI's drugs. It refused to disclose an executable version of that model to ASI, citing confidentiality reasons primarily. Now, the Court of Appeal didn't buy that argument. It highlighted specifically that the decisions of that body had a significant impact on people because they related on health and effectiveness of drugs. They also highlighted that the model was central to the decision making, and therefore its reliability was key to assessing whether the decision was a lawful one and a correct one to make in all the circumstances. And so in that context, it held that disclosing the executable version of how the model actually worked was essential to allow ASI to test whether the decision was reliable. It completely rejected arguments about confidentiality on the basis that the procedural fairness and the need for the claimant in that case to test whether the model was reliable and therefore whether the decision was the correct decision to make outweigh any concerns about confidentiality. And that should certainly be the case about decisions that affect the most important issues in our lives, whether that's whether we can get married to our partner or whether the Home Office deems that that's a sham marriage, whether we have our benefits suspended, which can lead to not being able to pay our rent or not being able to put food on the table, whether it's a decision about what category of prison sentence we should get. Those are really important decisions. And particularly where an algorithm is central to the decision making, And first of all, we need to know that. We need to know to what extent is the algorithm central to the decision making. But where it is central to the decision making, well, disclosure outweighs any concerns about confidentiality.
Tatiana, do you have anything to add to that? It's very interesting having these real life cases, because then you can see how much damage ADM can cause. But it's kind of too late to wait for the court to handle it. We can't do that across the board, can we?
No, absolutely not. I think going to court has to really be a last resort. That's not what we should be relying on as the kind of way to make sure these technologies are operating fairly. I wanted to pick up on one of the points that Ariane made at the end just there when she was speaking about the extent to which an ADM system is central to the decision-making process. We're often told when we make these freedom of information requests by government that this isn't really automated decision-making because there's a human in the loop. There's a human kind of looking at the output of the ADM system and deciding what to do with it. But one of the worries we have about that is this issue. It's a kind of well-documented psychological phenomenon known as automation bias. So it basically is a cognitive bias whereby people kind of put too much faith in computers and are quite inclined to just effectively rubber stamp the output of an algorithm. So even where technically you might have a human in the loop of a decision-making process, the worry is that really they're not deploying any meaningful oversight and they're just accepting whatever the algorithm has told them. And this is something that the ICIBI actually noted in the context of a kind of quite well-known example called the visa streaming tool, where basically the Home Office caseworkers were using a triage tool to process visa applications. And visa applications were either kind of given a green or a red categorization. And there was a worry that rather than taking that as a guideline or a recommendation, caseworkers were simply waving through the green applications and treating very harshly the red applications and not really applying any meaningful discretion.
Yes, we know about this automation bias that you talk about from the example of pilots who fly planes largely flown by digital technology. And apparently, if the plane is about to stall, there are all sorts of intuitive signals that human brains can pick up or should be on the lookout for. But quite a lot of pilots are just so focused on the digital technology that they don't pick up these signals and the plane stalls. But anyway, that's slightly going off piste. I just wanted to ask you about the relationship of all of this with data protection laws, and in particular, Article 22 of the General Data Protection, which you discussed in some length in both the PLP response and your article in the Prospect, Tatiana. What is the overlap here?
So Article 22 provides rights in relation to what is called solely automated processing that has legal or similarly significant effects on people. And it provides that where that's happening, where someone is being processed in this way, they have to be given meaningful information about that, the fact that it's happening, and also the opportunity to request human intervention. And one of the really interesting things about Article 22, or rather one of the complications, is its use of these quite vague terms, solely automated processing and legal or similarly significant effects. Those vague terms make it really difficult to know what the scope of Article 22 is and when it applies. Some people have suggested that for that reason, Article 22 should be scrapped, that it's not fit for purpose, that it's not useful. PLP's view is different. We think that Article 22 provides for a really important safeguard and that something like it should be in place. What we believe is that Article 22 should be reformed so that it prevents not only kind of clear cases where there's no human in the loop, but also protects where there's kind of de facto automated decision making. So where an official is simply rubber stamping an algorithm's output, that should be the scope of Article 22.
Ariane, have you got anything to add?
Article 22 also needs to be seen in context of the provisions of data protection law that is enforced at the moment more widely. So Articles 13 and 14, for example, provide a duty to provide information of how data is being processed. Article 13, when data is collected directly from a data subject, and Article 14, when it's not necessarily collected from the data subject, but it is being processed. Those two articles require disclosure of how that data is being used and processed, including as to whether it's being processed by automated means. And it's important to highlight that with the transparency articles of the UK GDPR, that information is required regardless of whether it's solely automated. You are required to provide information of how you are processing, even if you have partly automated processing. And you also have the right to access in Article 15, which is really important in terms of you as an individual being able to request information about how your data is being processed, including on whether it's being processed with automation. Now, that framework is really important. And what concerns us is that you have the proliferation of use of artificial intelligence and other algorithmic systems in government. And at the same time, there are signs that the government is considering moving away from the framework of the UK GDPR, altering it in some way. In addition to the concerns that we have about the noises about removing Article 22, we also have concerns about proposals to introduce a fee in order to process data subject access requests. Those are really concerning. At the end of the day, your personal data is your personal data. You have a right to them. And when the government uses that data for whatever purpose, it should tell you why, and it should give you opportunity to access information about it. And the idea at all that it would charge you for doing so is really objectionable and really detrimental to how data protection laws are meant to operate for the individual. And it really comes down to that. Technology, data processing, all of these things are not inherently good or bad, but if they're being used by the government, they should be used in a way that benefits individuals and helps their lives. It shouldn't be used in a way that goes against them or a way that really creates harm.
I must say I was surprised and shocked to read in the House of Lords report that the institutional landscape of monitoring automated decision-making systems and technology, I mean, they've counted at least 30 institutions that are conducting governance in slightly differing and overlapping ways. Obviously, the committee is calling for some sort of centralised system. How best at the PLP do you think this could be dealt with?
So we really welcome the Justice and Home Affairs Committee's recommendation for a single body and a single regulatory framework to kind of oversee how new technologies are being used. The scope of their report was obviously new technologies in law enforcement, which, you know, that there are some extremely important and significant applications of new technologies. But arguably, we could go wider as well. So where government is using new technologies to make decisions more generally, I think PLP would welcome kind of some investigation into whether the scope of this single independent body could be expanded to include government use of automated decision-making tools more generally.
Also, looking at the producers of this technology, again, there is a proposal in the report that somehow explainability and transparency should be built into these technologies. How this is to be achieved, I don't know, but it does seem a sensible proposal. You, at the PLP, point to the EU Commission's proposed regulation for the governance of artificial intelligence. It was adopted, I think, on the 21st of April last year. Why do you think this model might be one to follow?
Well, there are some key aspects of the proposed regulation which we consider very important. The first is the proposal for certification, indicating that a machine before it is deployed is conforming to regulatory standards. That's very important because that is an exercise that you should undertake before you start using something. Think about whether it actually conforms to the standards that you have agreed. There is a requirement that the design of high-risk artificial intelligence systems allows for effective human oversight. And this goes back to the point that Tatiana was making, that we should have de facto human oversight rather than rubber stamping the decisions of a machine. We also welcome that the EU Commission recognizes that there are some systems that are so faulty that should not be used at all, that there should be a blanket ban. And those are systems that use subliminal manipulative methods. So, for example, systems which exploit vulnerabilities related to age or a physical or mental disability in order to distort behavior. Now, those systems are beyond repair if their very method of operation involves this distortion of behavior and this manipulation of vulnerabilities. And that is really important also to bear in mind, that there are some systems that cannot be remedied or cannot be mitigated. And that is an exercise that you should be considering before you use them.
And both the EU and the House of Lords, in their different way, call for a central register of artificial intelligence technologies, algorithms. How is this to be achieved, do you think?
The algorithmic transparency standard is a good first step on that in terms of creating a template where public bodies using such systems need to provide certain information. In the algorithmic transparency standard, you have two tiers of information, high-level information, and then more specific information of how the algorithm works. And that information is provided and then is held in this central system. Now, that is a good idea. Our concerns with it, as we highlighted at the start, is that it's not mandatory and also that it doesn't go far enough. We particularly would like to see an executable copy of algorithmic systems being disclosed. And we do accept that perhaps some systems, the government will say, oh, well, if we're using this to detect fraud or if we're using this to really to try and catch those that may want to manipulate a system, then if we disclose it, then we're giving more information to the individual as to how to manipulate it. But at the very least there should be a requirement that the executable copy is disclosed to the national public body that is responsible for oversight. So even where there may be arguments against public disclosure, and we do feel that that bar should be set really high and it shouldn't be set in a way that can be relied upon in order basically to have a de facto we're not going to disclose rather than a de facto we do disclose. But where that bar is met, then at the very least that executable version should be disclosed to the oversight body, who will then be able to test its reliability. Because again, an algorithm that works well to detect fraud, great. But an algorithm that works badly, like the Horizon system did for the post office, that's bad.
The House of Lords calls for National Data Ethics Governance Body, which will act something like the Medicines Regulatory Agency. Before drugs are introduced into the market, they're given some sort of certification. It all seems like motherhood and apple pie. Where is the expertise, the training, and the resources going to come from for such centralized governance?
I think one thing to recognize is that often when people think of automated decision making, their minds go straight to super complex algorithms that use machine learning and that require really high levels of expertise to unpick what's going on there. And in fact, sometimes machine learning algorithms are opaque even to an expert. It's just not possible for a human to understand what's going on inside that black box. So that's what people tend to think of when they think of algorithms or automated decision making. But as a matter of fact, at least in terms of what we've been able to discover from our investigations, a lot of the ADM systems that government are currently using are actually relatively simple and shouldn't require really major technical expertise to understand what's going on there. So I think that kind of helps to mitigate the worry about resourcing. But also, our view is really that the default shouldn't be that these technologies are a good thing that should be rolled out as quickly as possible. Rather, there should be a much more cautious approach. And so having sufficient understanding of how they work is a necessary prerequisite for rolling them out. And if there isn't kind of sufficient resource there for government to be able to understand the technologies that they're using, then they shouldn't be using them at all.
I'm just reading retired Supreme Court Judge Jonathan Sumption's latest book, Law in the Time of Crisis. He observes in his first chapter that, quotes, over the 3 millennia of recorded history, humanity doesn't change very much. What changes is not its basic instincts or desires, but its capacity for giving effect to them. Indeed, one of the abiding tragedies of mankind is surely that its technological and organizational capacities have expanded so much faster than its social or moral sensibilities. And I think that rather sums up what we've been talking about in this session. Do you have any thoughts on that reflection?
I think that these new technologies are extremely powerful, and the key thing that we need to develop now is not more and more advanced technology. We have those available for use. What we need to develop, as Jonathan Sumption so eloquently pointed out, is our moral sensibility about when those tools should be used, how they should be used, and when, in fact, we should be stepping away.
I absolutely agree. And what I would add to that is that particularly in this jurisdiction, we are lucky that we have a public law, legislative and case law framework that has been developed for hundreds of years and has been used effectively to improve decision making and improve government accountability. And that framework should be integrated in the development, rollout and monitoring of new technologies, because all these principles that we have been discussing today, whether it's transparency, accountability, evaluation and review, there are principles that sit at the heart of our legal system and the way that our government administration has operated for centuries. All we're asking is that when we use technology rather than humans to make decisions, we abide by the same principles.
Yes, we have to be aware that though our digital overlords become more and more powerful and more omnipresent, we have to keep our humanity intact. Thank you so much, Ariane and Tatiana, for coming on LawPod UK to discuss this difficult and fast-moving subject. And I hope to be speaking to you again in the future.
Asti, thank you so much.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you, Rosalind.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row.